In Berkeley, I'm Dennis Bernstein. You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. John Pillager is an internationally renowned journalist and author whose career began in his native Australia before he moved to London in the 1960s. He has been a foreign correspondent, award-winning documentary filmmaker, and he writes for The New Statesman and The Guardian. I personally like what The Guardian says about Pillager's new book, Freedom Next Time. Quote, it allows us to hear the personal testimonies of those challenging power. The array of interviews with the voiceless and abused provides an indispensable corrective to the litany of disinformation we are fed by the media. And for this achievement, Pillager is surely the most outstanding journalist in the world today. John Pillager, I thank you for joining us, and it's good to have you at this time.
It's very good to be with you, Dennis. Thank you.
All right. Well, let's just start off with Palestine. You've made two films about Palestine. You've called them the same thing because it's the same problem over a 25-year period. Today, just looking at the wires coming down from Al Jazeera, at least four Palestinians have been killed in a series of airstrikes across Gaza Strip. Those are Israeli airstrikes. Two people died when Israel aircraft targeted a car in Khan Yunis. It goes on. Some 32 people were wounded by an F-16 fighter jet attack against the executive force building in Gaza City, the most densely populated city in the world. Talk a little bit about the situation there now and the kind of cynical and brutal policy coming out of the West that continues to inflame the situation.
Well, you have to imagine Gaza, if you can. Gaza is a prison. It's an open prison. On one side is the sea. On another side is Egypt, through which there is a border, but it's closed. And on the other side is Israel, which locks people in. There are more than 1 million people living there. There is almost no real work. There is no real sustenance for those who need it most, like children, the ill, and the elderly. The United Nations has issued many reports saying how malnourished children are, some of the most malnourished children in the world. It's an enforced ghetto, and it's enforced by the United States. When I say the United States, yes, Israel does it, but really all of the wars conducted by Israel and the impositions of Israel in the Middle East are American-backed. And they're done, as you've just described, with American aircraft. They happen to be flown by Israelis. That's very important to understand that in the reporting. I've just watched a television report here in which it described the most horrific bombing as, even using that euphemism, airstrikes. How anodyne that sounds. And four Hamas militants were killed. How do they know? And militants about what? Militants about running the country. Hamas was voted in to run the country in democratic elections, and that sorely upset the United States, and they decided to stop it. And the tragic civil war of a kind that has erupted in Gaza is entirely caused by outside forces, about people not even being allowed to democratically run their own country, choose their own people. If I sound very strong about this, it is because I've been to Gaza and I've seen the conditions there, and it's just unreal to come away from a place like that and really know what's causing this horror and then sort of be transported into our safe and comfortable world. Gaza is the metaphor, a very live and bleeding and metaphor for the whole Middle East, and probably for the whole world in terms of the imposition of great power on powerless people.
You talk about this situation from the point of view of somebody, a journalist, if you will, who went there, who saw, who went there, and then went there 25 years later with a camera and saw much of the same situation based on much of the same policy. We hear language like a roadmap. A map, yeah. A map. That would be interesting, wouldn't it? It's the only state, the only thing close to a state is a state of mind.
Yeah.
One, there is no attempt. It's a cynical discussion to even talk about a map. Is that right? How can
Cynical, absolutely right. It's a cynical discussion, but it's a farcical discussion. And it requires the kind of contortion of intellect and morality that most people aren't capable of, in my opinion. I think most people live their lives in a fairly straightforward manner. Power does not. We're different. We're different from those who are in unaccountable power. And that's true now in the United States. It's true to a large degree here in Britain and in other so-called democracies. The word itself has just fallen into disrepute. Yes, I made two films. I made the first one, Palestine is Still the Issue, I believe in 1975, I think. I made the second one, Palestine is Still the Issue, in 2002. And the reason I kept the title was because it was still the issue. That fundamentally, over that period of 20-odd years, nothing had changed. Fundamentally, nothing had changed. The Palestinian people were subjected to the world's longest military occupation, were an indigenous people in their own homeland, denied the rights of living peacefully in their own homeland, denied the right of even living peacefully beside those who came later, that is the Israelis. Those who want to believe the biblical story of 3,000 years ago, go ahead. there are plenty of myths in the world, but we're dealing with lives now. Israelis and Palestinians could be living together today in peace were it not for the power ambitions of the United States combining with the more extreme power ambitions of Zionist Israel. I don't say that with a light heart. It's just true. And any journalist who's been going backwards and forwards to that part of the world, as I have for so many years, who denies that truth because they're worried about they're going to be attacked by Zionists and get a blizzard of emails and the usual stuff, well, then they should stand up to that because that's the truth. And until the people of Palestine are given justice, which will automatically give security to the people of Israel, then the rest of the Middle East will remain in a sort of perpetual torment, and indeed much of the world.
You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. My name is Dennis Bernstein. We're speaking with John Pilger. His new book is Freedom Next Time. Of course, Mr. Pilger, we're looking forward to you coming here in the Bay Area. I guess you're going to be here in June, and we'll be happy to meet you then. Good to have you now on the telephone talking about Palestine. And I want to sort of take you into Iraq and bridge it with Palestine in the context of the nature of journalism. The reason why the oppression and this, I guess we can call it an ethnic cleansing, continues of Palestine is the same reason that the U.S. administration with Britain could take us into a war, because the journalists were both complicit and sort of activist patriot cheerleaders for the wars. Could you talk a little bit about how this kind of policy is able, can continue because of the failure of journalism?
Well, in my view, it's impossible to understand what the hell is going on in the world unless you put it in the context of imperial ambitions. Otherwise, if you don't do that, then it all seems like there's sort of fires breaking out here and there, and you then start to be persuaded into thinking about the world in personalities, bad dictators, and this and that and so on. But if you think about the world in terms of the true and demonstrable ambitions of great power to impose itself on the world, in essence no different from the way great European powers imposed themselves on the world in the late 19th century, same thing, then you begin to understand it. And that imperial power always has its courtiers, and it always has its euphemisms. It has its code words. Because people don't want to stand up and say, we're imperialists. Now, before the Second World War in Britain, you could do that and feel quite proud. You know, I'm sort of imperial, I'm part of the British Empire, and it's a good thing and all that. But the Second World War really threw that away, because the Nazis and the fascists were also imperialists. So they gave imperialism a very bad name. And the word was effectively banished from the dictionary until George W. Bush turned up, and now, thanks to him, it's back. And that's how the world, in my opinion, has to be made sense of. And once you see it that way, when you see the courtiers of imperialism, the apologists for it, the apologists for power, and liberalism, you know, it's not just neoconservatism, neoliberalism. Sorry, we're getting mixed up in these dreadful terms, but basically liberalism plays its own part in believing it has a missionary mandate to intervene in countries. So while there is this excuse for imperialism, bringing democracy to the Middle East, you know, saving the people of Kosovo, and so on and so forth. I mean, all this is pretty threadbare now. I mean, anyone with half their wits could really see through it, surely. But a lot of people have had a lifetime of conditioning. And that conditioning comes from the principal courtiers of imperialism, and that is, unfortunately, journalism. So-called mainstream, another euphemism. But really, that means establishment. Mainstream means establishment journalism. And I've had recent examples of that, particularly pompous examples from the New York Times, saying that, like the BBC, you know, we look both sides of it. We're really newspaper of record or broadcasters of record. They're not. They're not. And I think more and more people are deconstructing the news, understanding that the mainstream are the messengers of a very, very dangerous imperial period in our history. And that, I think the fact that public awareness has risen so rapidly in the last few years has become very threatening, not only to politicians, but to journalists.
It's incomprehensible to me the way certain stories are covered. Now, I'm sure you're somewhat familiar with the big story in the United States about the Attorney General firing sort of 9 regional prosecutors because they weren't pro-Bush. Now, this is the Attorney General who created the structure and the backdrop, who called the Geneva Convention quaint for a wide-ranging, forward-fighting tool to be used by the United States government. That's called torture. Not a word in pages and weeks of scandal, not a word that this man should be standing before an international dock.
That's right. Sorry, I interrupted.
No, go on, please.
Yeah, well, the fact that he was Bush's attorney general in Texas, And he used to write down, I understand, summaries of the people on death row in Texas and hand them to the governor for the governor to decide whether they should live or die. I won't go into detail of this because that's all I know, but I'm told reliably that's the way the system of life and death would work in the prisons of Texas. And this man, who's little more than a crony of Bush, ends up Attorney General of the United States. So it's not surprising that he regards the Geneva Convention as quaint. But then so much has happened in the last few years that really make a mockery of all those great tablets that were handed down by those Georgian gentlemen in the 18th century. I mean, they can be questioned too, but their very essence, even, you know, of which is based on the Magna Carta and the revolution in this country of individual justice, people being innocent until they're proven guilty and having the right of habeas corpus, and all those basic tenets of law have just been thrown aside. It's very, when Norman Mailer said a couple of years ago that the United States, he felt, was in a pre-fascist, entering a pre-fascist era. I remember I put this, in one of my films, I put this to Ray McGovern, the former CIA man who's done an excellent job of standing up to a lot of these people in the Bush administration. And he laughed. He said, well, I wish it was pre-fascist. I don't believe it is pre. I think we're in it.
Well, let's just talk a little bit more about journalism. How about we turn the conversation this way? We've heard a lot about sources, about Judith Miller, the former New York Times lead reporter on Iraq, who had sources inside the White House she needed to protect. Of course, here's a journalist whose sources sold us the war. How do you evaluate your sources? How do we get to the bottom of a story? How should the people of the United States who have not yet been told about the ethnic cleansing of Palestine, how should they be told? What sources should be used to inform them?
The New York Times went along with Judith Miller because it wanted to. They don't like to say that. And all right, Judith Miller is gone. But when you look back and read what she wrote, it was clearly propaganda. There was nothing substantial apart from the White House to back it up. And it is not the role of journalism under any circumstances to take the word of government or authority at face value ever. I believe that the New York Times was aware that she was skating on the thinnest of ice, but they had gone along with Bush. They went along with Bush from the moment he was elected, actually. And month after month, we had these almost ludicrous reports from Judith Miller. How does one assess sources? Well, I think people, you know, Dennis, are much more savvy than most journalists give them credit for. I think they are. Then they're becoming more savvy by the minute. I think they get to know their own sources, their own journalists, and trust them. I think they trust people like Seymour Hersh. You earn the trust by getting it almost as right as you can. And people will then go along with you. That's my experience.
I mentioned earlier in the introduction, I like what The Guardian was saying about your new book, Freedom Next Time. It talks about how you do interviews with the voiceless and abused, and it provides an indispensable corrective. These are the voices challenging power. Is that the job? Finding a way to question authority and challenge power? Is that the heart of the matter?
That's the basic job of journalism. You know, I'm often asked, well, you know, when did you first see the light? You know, when did you start your campaigning, your crusade? Well, I say nonsense. I never had a sense of that at all. But I did have a sense of a basic job of journalism, and that is to lift up the rocks, to tear down the facades, not accept the official version of events, and question it and be independent. And always remember that journalism is about humanity. So if you appear to be on the side of people and their interests, fine. But it is about calling power to account. And I don't believe that you can do that by being a courtier of power.
And in terms of the sourcing, is it not a crucial part of your work, has it not been, to actually go to those who have been oppressed by a particular policy and let them speak for themselves?
Yeah, you see, I think the greatest source, I don't think there's any mystery about this. You know, you don't go through piles of things, find some smoking gun. All right, some do. And occasionally it's there. You know, we have the great edifice of Watergate and Deep Throat and all that. That's very unusual. The greatest sources are ordinary people. In my experience, ordinary people all over the world very seldom deceive you. They almost always tell you what happened. Now, what they tell you may not be absolutely correct, because people can see things happening and have different versions. That's just the way we are. You know, you can both see an accident and tell differently about it. So you have to talk around it. But generally speaking, their good faith makes them excellent sources. And that's been my experience, that the best sources, yes, are documents that reveal. But it's ordinary people who reveal.
Are they the ones who sell you the story, who convince you it's time to go, to bring your cameras, to bring your pencils and go on site? Is it usually something you hear that bubbles up from the bottom, from the people?
Well, it's the way you talk to them. If you speak to people and you're genuinely interested in hearing what happened and about them and about what they saw and witnessed and let them speak, you'll get as close to the truth as it's possible. You won't get the whole truth, but you'll get a pretty good version of it.
We're speaking with John Pillager. We just have a couple of minutes left, Mr. Pillager, and I want to guide you back to the current wars. Obviously, the United States is now on the ground. I'm afraid to think what's happening in what really does look like this search and destroy mission for the three soldiers. I don't even want to try and figure out how many people died, and we will never know, in this so-called search for the soldiers. We're now threatened with another war in Iran, and we actually see a related proxy oil war, could easily be, in Somalia. You want to take a look at the scene now, talk about what's happening and your concerns?
Well, I think that this can all be stopped if the American people stop it. And there's no doubt of the congressional elections last November, the majority voted for an end to Iraq. They didn't get it. Perhaps they learned from that. But every poll I see suggests to me very strongly that Americans are against what its government is doing around the world. And I've worked in the United States, and I've seen the great movements begin in the South, the civil rights movement, the Vietnam War movement, and so on and so forth, the Freeze movement, and they're enormously powerful. This has not yet coerced, it's not yet been brought together as as a national movement. And I think it's really up to Americans. They are probably, not as the propaganda says, but in terms of bringing peace to and lack of threat to much of the world, probably the most important people there are at the moment, because they can stop it. It's really up to them, and it's about the action, the direct action that Americans take.
Are they going to be sold another war in Iran? Are the papers predictably doing what they need to do to make sure we have another patriotic war?
Well, they're not going to be sold it. There'll be a period where, you know, the propaganda against Iran has been well and truly on. Iran, it's just ludicrous. Iran is an original signatory of the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Act, something that the United States has broken time and time again, that Israel doesn't even belong to. The International Atomic Energy Agency has said that Iran does not have a nuclear weapons program. And, you know, the UN sanctions, Security Council sanctions, was a classic act of bribery by the United States. Iran is being targeted because it is an independent state and a big and powerful one with oil in the Middle East. And that's intolerable to the present administration. That's the only reason. One doesn't have to like the regime, though it's far more complex, the regime, than it's painted. But then one doesn't have to like the regime in Washington, and no one really wants to attack it and kill Americans. So I think it's an attack on Iran is quite likely. I think Bush, the notion that Bush might try and do it near the end of his time is quite a feasible one, really. We can only guess. We don't know. But certainly all the ships are in place, the cruise missiles are primed, the war plan is there, and so on and so forth. And in my experience, when this great monster called the Pentagon decides that it's going to war, not a lot stops it. The sheer momentum of it. So we'll see.
All right. We will see. We will see you, John Pelger, in about a month or so, a couple of months, coming to the Bay Area. Your new book is Freedom Next Time, in which you go into some of the key subjects you've covered in your films over so many years. We thank you. Let me thank you for our audience for all your good work, and we know the work that is still to come. Thanks for being with us on Flashpoints.
Thank you, Dennis. It's a pleasure always.